Okay, I thought we'd speak about Purim instead of the parasha. Let's start with a discussion of Amalek, and then we will apply what we establish by Amalek to understand Purim better. Amalek, from all the enemies that we had, and we had plenty of them, still do, didn't seem to cause as much damage to us as others did. And yet, they're the ones singled out to be hated and annihilated and their memory blotted out throughout the generations. Why? The simple answer is because they were the first. After Kriyas Yamsuf, they were the first to have the courage to attack us, and they opened the floodgates after that for everybody. Rashi says, after Kriyas Yamsuf, the entire world was afraid of us because what they saw, this miraculous splitting of the sea and the saving of the Jewish people and the destruction of the Egyptian army in the most miraculous way, and we were like a hot bath. Nobody wanted to touch us. And Amalek jumped in, and even though they got burned, they cooled us off in the eyes of the nations, and they opened the floodgates. They were the first, and therefore they were the worst, because they, everything that happened after that happened because of them. Okay, but that still doesn't answer the question, because why weren't Amalek afraid? The whole world was afraid of us and not Amalek. They were crazy. They were badder than everybody else. What exactly was it about Amalek that they weren't afraid when the whole world was? So I think a possible answer is the following: that until Amalek came on the scene, there were two schools of thought in the world, two philosophies. There were those that believed in God. Those were basically the household of Avram and the people that he influenced. And there were those that believed in idols, idol worship. They believed basically in many intelligent powers, they felt, that controlled the world. Those were the two schools of thought. Amalek introduced a third school of thought called atheism. They didn't believe in anything. Where is the source for that? The following. The Medrash says on the pasuk Vayishma Yisro, says Yisro heard the splitting of the Red Sea, and he heard about the war of Amalek. So the Medrash on that says the following, quotes a pasuk in Mishlei, Takeleitz, hit the scoffer, Upesi Yarim, and the fool will wake up. Applying that to the fact that when Amalek were hit, Yisro woke up. Says Reb Tzadok HaKohen from Lublin on that Medrash, a letz is someone who believes in nothing, and a pesi is somebody who believes in everything. Yisro believed in every idol worship there was. He went from one to the other till he finally came to a belief in God. And Amalek believed in nothing, not even idols. They were total atheists. So this idea of Amalek therefore not being afraid is based on this idea. If you were an idol worshiper and you saw the splitting of the Red Sea, you would have to conclude that there is some power, may not be God, but some God that likes the Jewish people and can do fantastic things to punish those that come against them and to save them. And you'd be afraid to start up with the Jewish people. But if you were an atheist and believed that every single thing in this world was the result of haphazard accident, and there was no intelligent forces that ran the world, then what should be afraid of? You would attribute the splitting of the Red Sea to an accident. And statistically, accidents don't happen twice in the same place. Lightning doesn't strike twice in the same place. So why would you be afraid of the Jewish people? Now you may ask, I understand that atheists don't believe in the splitting of the Red Sea. But if an atheist witnessed the splitting of the Red Sea, how could he remain an atheist? How could he attribute that to haphazard chance? The answer is possible. I'll prove it to you. There was a Russian scientist named Emanuel Velikovsky. And he believed, he was an astronomer, a geologist, an Egyptologist, and he claimed to have found proof that all the 10 plagues happened, the splitting of the Red Sea happened, and the sun stood still for Yeshua happened. And he claimed to have found proof to all of them. He claimed to have found a papyrus in hieroglyphics that reported the 10 plagues from the Egyptian standpoint. There's blood everywhere, nothing to drink, and so on. The rest of the scientific community disputed that, because there are 5 or 6 different ways of interpreting hieroglyphics, and according to other ways of interpreting, it had nothing to do with the 10 plagues. It was somebody's laundry list or something like that, whatever. So, but he claimed it was the 10 plagues, and he believed. He also claimed to have studied the bed of the Red Sea and found that it was exposed to the air at some time in its history. He also made astronomical calculations that showed that the world had stopped rotating on its axis for a period of close to half a day back in the time of Yeshua, and he found a Chinese legend from that time that said they had a long night in China around that time. So you would imagine that this person would be a tremendous believer, because he put his career on the line, because he was ostracized by the scientific community for purporting to prove the Torah. So he really believed this. So you would imagine he's a tremendous believer. He believed in all these miracles, and he was an atheist. So how did he believe these things happened? That was his theory. He wrote a book called Worlds in Collision, which I do not suggest you read, but he says the following. He says the planet Venus was not in its set orbit at that time in history, and it came on a near-miss collision course with the Earth a few times. And every time Venus came close to the Earth, the gravitational pull of Venus on the Earth wreaked havoc. And he shows how every one of the 10 plagues could have been caused by the gravitational pull of Venus, how the gravitational pull of Venus pulled the Red Sea out of its bed, and how it stopped the Earth rotating on its axis. Now, that is absurd. Not because it couldn't have happened like that. And not because if somebody says that God chose to bring Venus close to the Earth to cause the 10 plagues and the splitting of the Red Sea and the stopping of the Earth rotating, you're not an apikoros. It could be. I don't care how God did the miracle. The Ralbag says most miracles are done by God in the most natural way possible. They're not necessarily totally against nature. But that's not the miracle. The miracle is the timing. And to believe that a senseless, unintelligent piece of rock, by accident, just happened to come close to the earth when the Jews needed to leave Egypt and needed 10 plagues, and just happened to 7 days later come back and split the Red Sea just when the Jews are there and need it to be split. And 40 years later, not a day before or after, there's Venus again to stop the earth rotating just when Yeshua needs a longer day, is absurd. I mean, Venus must have really liked us, but Venus is a senseless, unintelligent piece of rock. So, but you see that a atheist can believe in Kriyas Yamsuf and still attribute it to total haphazard coincidence and accident and chance. And that's why there are certain key words that we find in regards to Amalek. Asher korcha, korcha's mikra. They came against us with chance, with accident, with happening. Baderech, they came against us in the derech, in the path. If you believe that there's a God who created this world with a purpose, then there's a path. There's a purpose, and there's a goal, right? And you're on a path towards some goal. But if you believe that the world is just a product of accident, then there's nothing more than the accident of the moment. There's no path. It's just total accident one time after another. Another word that we find by Amalek is machar, tomorrow. Go fight with Amalek tomorrow. Esther said, tomorrow I'll do. Because Amalek has no tomorrow. If you believe the world is just a product of haphazard accidents, the only way you know is the accident right now. The fact there's going to be another accident next second, how do you know? You can assume, maybe. But it's no reason to assume that the world's going to have another accident and continue the next second. But if you believe in a creation with a purpose, then there's a tomorrow. So that's why Amalek in Gematria is Suffolk, because they raise doubts in our mind. Right? If we wouldn't know there is another alternative explanation to how the world got here, right? Senseless evolution, then our belief in God and creation would be stronger. The fact that we know that there are intelligent people, very intelligent people, that believe in that, puts doubts in our mind. Maybe they're right. It has to weaken our emun, it has to weaken our belief. And the stronger we are in believing in God, the weaker Amalek is, because they have to take in consideration that we believe what they don't believe. So Amalek is Suffolk. And therefore, Amalek is called Rashis, the beginning. Not just because they were the first ones to attack us, but I'd like to compare it to a tug of war. A tug of war, you have two teams. One on one side of the rope, one on the other side, and they're trying to pull the middle of the rope towards their side. Amalek is on one end, extreme, don't believe in anything. We're on the other extreme, we believe in God. And everybody else is in the middle, believe in idols, idol worship. We're trying to pull them from idol worship to belief in God, and Amalek is trying to pull them from idol worship to atheist. And this is the struggle between us and Amalek throughout the generations. When are we vulnerable to Amalek? When we have doubts if God is the one who's controlling the world. What was the first time that we had to contend with Amalek? When they questioned in the desert if God was with them to give them a drink of water. They needed water, and they said, Hayesh Hashem bikirbeinu imai. And the Mefarshim explained, what was the question? They had a cloud in the daytime, a pillar of fire at the nighttime. They saw the 10 plagues. They saw Kriyas Yamsuf. What was the question? So they say the question was, maybe God only involves himself in the world when you need spectacular things done, like splitting the Red Sea, bringing 10 plagues. But for the normal, everyday things, like getting a drink of water, that God gave over into the hands of nature. So what they wanted to know, is God there for the natural things or only for the supernatural things? When we have, when we have doubts whether God is involved in the natural things, then we are vulnerable to Amalek, who don't believe that God's involved even in the supernatural things. So that's why the rabbis say that as long as Amalek is in the world, Ein HaKiseh Shalem Ve'Ein HaShem Shalem, God's throne isn't complete, nor is his name not complete. What does that mean? It's based on a pasuk in the end of Bishalach. Ki yod al keis ka milchama l'Hashem ba'amolek midor dor. So the way Rashi learns the pasuk is the following: God lifted his hand over his throne and made an oath that he will wage war with Amalek from generation to generation. This struggle between us and them, are we going to bring the world to belief or are they going to bring the world to atheism, is an ongoing struggle. The word for throne is kiseh, but in that pasuk the aleph is missing, case. So the God's throne isn't complete. And God's name, which is usually yud kei vav kei, is only the first two letters, yud kei, ka. So that's what the rabbis say, the throne isn't complete and the name isn't complete. There are very deep understandings of that, but I'm going to tell you what I think is a simple understanding. God's throne is a symbol of his divine providence, his divine control of the world. As a king sits in his throne, you know that he's in charge. As long as Amalek is in the world, it's hard to see God sitting on the throne and controlling the events of the world, because it's easier to attribute it to social, political, economic causes and effects of total accident. You don't see God's hand that clearly. So the Aleph is off the kisei. The Aleph represents God, and he's off the throne. Now Molech, you don't see him that clearly. And what's left is Kesh. Kesh is hidden, obscure. The world is very obscure when Amalek is around. They take the Aleph off the kisei. And the name of God, the simple meaning of Yudke Vavke, is Hoya Hove Yiye. God was, is, and always will be. If you take the name and split it into two, the first two letters are Yud and Hey. From those letters you can make Hoya and Yihya. Just have to repeat the letters. But you can't make Hove. From the last two letters, Vavhe, you could make Hove. So I think it means the following. As long as Amalek is in the world, you can still see God in the past. Look at the Torah. You can see him in the future. Look at the Navi. You know where it's hard to see God? In the present. So as long as Amalek is in the world, the Aleph is off the kisei, and it's left obscure, and the Vavhe is out of God's name because it's hard to see God in the present. The Vilna Gaon, amongst others, points out that this effect of Amalek was only when there is no Beis HaMikdash. When there was a Beis HaMikdash, even though Amalek was still in the world, the Beis HaMikdash counteracted and nullified the effect, the negative effect of Amalek. Because there were 10 miracles that happened in the Beis HaMikdash every day, you could feel God's presence in the Beis HaMikdash. So the Beis HaMikdash offset, balanced out the negative effect of Amalek. And therefore, those letters come back into the world when there is a Beis HaMikdash. The Aleph from the Kisei and the Vav Hei from God's name. Where do you see that? The Pasuk says, Ki Bochar Hashem B'Tzion, Eva L'Moshav Lo. God chose Tzion, he desired it to be the place he would dwell. The word desired, Eva, is spelled Aleph Vav Hei. Those are the letters that are missing from God's throne and from his name. So those letters reappear in the world when there is a Beis HaMikdash. Okay. Now, let's understand a little bit about Amalek, and then we'll begin to apply it to Purim. First thing, what's worse, idol worship or atheism? The answer is atheism is worse, for a few reasons. One reason is that idol worship can be used as a springboard to belief in God. How do I know? Because Avraham Avinu, that's how he came to believe in God. He believed in all these powers, and then he saw that there's always another power that's stronger. There must be one major power who created all of them. Yisro, same thing, came to belief in God by investigating all the different avodah zarahs in the world. So you can come to belief in God through Avodah Zarah, but you can never come to belief in God through atheism. You can renounce your atheism and become a believer, but atheism is not going to be a springboard to belief in God. It's the antithesis of belief. Second difference between an atheist and a idol worshiper is, are there any ethics in this world? Morality, right, wrong, good, bad. If you believe that the world is a product of total accident and there are no intelligent forces that run the world, then there can't be any ethics. There can't be anything right, wrong, good, bad about an accident. It's purposeless. The only ethics you can have if you're an atheist is situational ethics. Meaning, don't step on my toes because I'm going to step on your toes and we won't be able to coexist. So stepping on toes is not a good thing for the existence of the world. Is there anything intrinsically wrong with stepping on toes? No, toes are an accident. They evolved accidentally. How can there be something wrong with stepping? There can't be anything wrong with stepping on an ant if the ant came about by accident. Total, haphazard, purposeless accident. Namela, there can't be anything wrong with stepping on your aunt from Chicago either, because she's a bigger accident. So there can't be anything wrong with murder or anything else, because everything in this world is purposeless and an accident. The only kind of ethics are contrived ethics that people create in order to make people be able to live together. But there's no intrinsic right, wrong, good, bad in this world. Second difference, or third difference, is how they look at the Jewish people. What makes us special? We are special. We are not special because we're the smartest people in the world. We're not. Aristotle, was not Jewish, and the Rambam says he was the smartest person that lived, less than a Navi, maybe even Shlomo HaMelech. We're not the strongest people in the world, right? We are not the richest people in the world, no matter what anybody thinks. Bill Gates still has not yet converted, or whatever. There are richer people than Jews. The Saudi oil magnates are richer than any Jew in the world. So we are not the richest people in the world. So what are we? Torah says what we are. What makes us special? Two things. Mi goy godol asher lo Elohim krovim elav kashem Elokeinu. Who has a God so close to them who always hears our prayers like our God hears our prayers? Meaning, as individuals, few suffer. But as a nation, we are always, in the end, saved. We left Mitzrayim, even though 4/5 of the Jewish people died. But as a nation, God was there for us. We left Bavel. We survived the Holocaust. We survived the Inquisition. The biggest miracle of history is that we're still around. So God is always there for us. First, greatness of the Jewish people. Second, Mi goy gadol asher lo chukim mishpatim tzadikin kechol haTorah azos asher anochi nosein tmechem. We have a book, a Torah, that guides every aspect of our life and is really a magnificent book, which even the goyim understand. It's a book of books, the Bible. They may not think it applies to them or applies altogether, but it's really a magnificent book that really guides every aspect of life, which means that every aspect of our life is important to God. Otherwise, what do you care what we do? What we eat, what we think, whatever. Those are the two things that make the Jewish people important. One is we have a Torah, and we have a special relationship with God. Now, if you're an idol worshiper, you have to take those two things into consideration. You may not like it. You may deny that it's true, but the essence, right, the ideas, right, the concept, you can have to accept. There can be a Torah of right and wrong, right? You may disagree what's right and wrong, but there is an idea of right and wrong. And it's possible to get close to a God. And the Jewish people seem to have a closeness to some God because we're still around. But if you're an atheist, neither of those things make any sense. You can't get close to a God if there is none. And a Torah makes no sense because there's no purpose to this world, so there can't be any right, wrong guidance. This is okay to eat, that's not. Everything is just a haphazard accident. So if you're an idol worshiper, you have to take note of the specialness of the Jewish people. You may hate us. You may resent it. You may be jealous. You may deny it. But you have to take it in consideration. If you're an atheist, it means nothing to you. And I think that is the meaning of the following Gemara in Megillah. The Gemara says that when Haman came and asked Achashverosh for permission to destroy the Jewish people, and he offered him Aseres Alothim Kikar Kesef, 10,000 talents of silver, Achashverosh said, keep your money and do what you want. So the Gemara says, you know what it can be compared to? There was a person who had a big mound of earth on his field, and he was looking to get it off the field. It bothered him. But he couldn't find anybody to take it. Somebody else had a big hole in his field, and he was looking for landfill. One day he passes by the field of the guy with the big mound, and he says, could you sell me that mound of earth? I could use it to fill up the hole I have in my field. That's just sell it to you. I've been looking for somebody to take it off my hands for free. Just take it. So that was Achashverosh and Haman. But it's very significant. Achashverosh was the idol worshipper. How did he see the Jewish people? As a big mound of earth that bothered him. We're something, but it bothers him. Haman was the Amaleki. How did he see the Jewish people? As a big hole in the ground. Meaningless. Worthless. But what bothered him is that these nothings, this hole in the ground, thinks they're something. So Amalekim look at us totally with disregard, and the rest of the world looks something that has to be taken into consideration. May not like us, but we're something in their eyes. Okay. Next, where did Amalek come from? Why did they create this philosophy of atheism Why were they the first ones to be the atheists? So let's psychoanalyze Amalek, and when you psychoanalyze somebody, you go back to the parents. Who were the parents of Amalek? Timnah and Eliphaz ben Esav. Who was Timnah? Timnah was a princess, and she could have married into royalty, but she was so impressed with the household of Avraham Avinu that she wanted to join that family. She came to join the family of Avraham, and Avraham rejected her outright. She didn't give up. A few years later, she came to Yitzchak, and he rejected her. She didn't give up. She came to Yaakov, and he rejected her. And the rabbis say they were wrong. You never reject somebody with both hands. You push him away with the left hand, bring him close with the right hand. Why did they do that? Obviously because they saw the seeds of Amalek in her. But they should have found some way not to reject her totally, out of hand. They didn't have to integrate her into the family of Avraham, but not to push her away with two hands. Since they did, we suffer from Amalek. So Timnah was, she said, and she said, and finally, I can't get into the front door of this family, I'll come through the back door. And she became a pelegish, a concubine to Eliphaz ben Esav, the black sheep of the family. That was a mother. Who was the father of Amalek? Eliphaz, the son of Esav. Now, if your mother was rejected by the Jewish people, what is the knee-jerk reaction to rejection? Sour grapes. Meaning, somebody rejects me, so I say, who are they anyway? I never wanted them anyway, because they're nobody. Because if they're somebody, somebody rejected me. But if they're a nobody, so who cares if they rejected me? They're a nobody. So if you're looking for a job, right, and you're really interested in this job, and then they tell you, we're not interested in you, so you say, that company's not worth anything anyway, who would ever want to work with them? That's called sour grapes. If your mother was rejected by the Jewish people, you would have an incentive to create a philosophy that would make nothing of the Jewish people, which is atheism. If your father was Eliphaz ben Esav, if in fact you believe that there are no intelligent forces that run this world, so then what does run the world? The answer is power, might, survival of the fittest. Whoever has the might survives. Might can come in two ways: power, physical might, the sword, or money. Esav believed in physical might, al charb chatichi, live by the sword. His son Eliphaz was more refined, and he believed that money ran the world. That was his name, Eliphaz. My God is gold. How do we know that also? Because when his father sent him to kill Yaakov, he took his money away instead. So if your father believed that it was power and might that ran the world, power of money, and your mother was rejected by the Jewish people, you would want a philosophy that combined the two. That you believe that might makes right, and that the Jewish people are worthless. Atheism fits the bill, like we explained. So that's why they became the atheists. Okay. Now let's see how this all applies to Purim. We said that whenever the Jewish people have doubts whether God is controlling the world, we are vulnerable to Amalek. And that happened in the time of Ahasuerus and before. The first sin the Jewish people committed was Polchu L'Tzelem Shel Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar set up an idol, and he demanded everybody bow to it, or they will be killed. The Jewish people made the following cheshbon. They said, God has abandoned us, put us into Golus, right? He exiled us from our land, destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. Basically, God has abandoned us. The Nevi'im were full of this, that's what the Jewish people thought. And therefore, God is no longer controlling us. So who is in control? And powerful people, like Nebuchadnezzar. So we better listen to Nebuchadnezzar, even though we're going to get into the bad graces of God, but better be in the good graces of Nebuchadnezzar, because he's the one who's in charge. God has abandoned us. That was the first mistake. They didn't believe that God still had to do with them. They thought that God abandoned them. And that led to the second sin. When you don't believe that God is involved in the world, then the Jewish people have no importance. Our importance is our relationship with God. If that relationship doesn't exist, then we have no importance at all. So you don't feel that you're important. That was the second sin. Not that they went to the party. They enjoyed it. They had to go to the party. Because if you don't go to Achashverosh's party when you're invited, right, you don't go to any parties after that. That's what happened to Vashti. She refused to come when Achashverosh invited her, and she lost her head. So it's pikuach nefesh. If Achashverosh says come, you have to come. Mordechai was there according to the Medrash. Everybody was there. The problem was they enjoyed it. What does that mean? What was the party celebrating? The downfall of the Jewish people. Achashverosh made a cheshbon. The 70 years that the Nevi'im had said would be the duration of Golus Bavel was over, and the Jews were not redeemed. So he assumed that was it. They're not going to be redeemed. So he took out the Kalim of the Beis HaMikdash and the Big Day Kahuna and dressed up and celebrated the downfall of the Jewish people. And the Jews were there and they enjoyed it. How can you enjoy a party that's celebrating your downfall? The answer is, if you are a self-hating Jew who doesn't believe that God has any connection to us, then you know what you get enjoyment out of? Rubbing shoulders with important people, because they control the world. I mean, how many Chevrei Knesset ran to shake the hand of Arafat years ago, right? They wouldn't want to touch the guys. Who knows what kind of diseases he had, right? But a murderer of Jews, to shake his hand, because he's a powerful person. So those are Jews who have no self-respect, no self-esteem, right? Don't believe in anything. So what is it to be a Jew? So you rub shoulders with important people. We were invited to Achashverosh's party. They enjoyed that. Achashverosh is a powerful person. They had no self-esteem or self-respect. That was the second sin. And like we said, whenever we are weak in our belief, in our relationship to God, in God's relationship to the world, we are vulnerable to Amalek, who came in the guise of Haman, who Amaleki. And Haman, he totally denigrated any importance to Jews, and therefore when Mordechai bothered him, it was beneath his dignity to deal with one Jew. So destroy them all, right? You don't kill one cockroach, you kill them all. If they're worthless, vayives be'enov, right? It was beneath his dignity, right, to deal with one Mordechai. So therefore he wanted to destroy the entire Jewish people. And how did he want to do it? In a way that showed his philosophy that the world is just hefker. And that's why he decided to destroy us through a goro, through a lot, which is total chance. And that's why the Megillah says, Hipil Pur, Hu HaGoro. Seemingly the simple meaning of the sentence is, it's a translation. Pur, according to some opinions, is a Persian word, which we don't know. So if you want to know what a Pur is, in Hebrew it's a Goro. Okay, that makes sense, that the Megillah would have to translate the word so we know what it is if it's a Persian word. But it translates it twice in the Megillah, in Perek Gimel and again in Perek Tes. Why do I need two translations? I know already from Perek Gimel what it is. Why translate it again? And according to other opinions, Pur is not a Persian word, it's a Hebrew word. So why do you have to translate it altogether? And if it's an archaic word, and the more common word is Goro, then don't tell me Pur altogether. I understand if it's a Persian word, you want to keep the flavor of what Haman called it. But if it's a Hebrew word, so just tell me the used word, Goro. Don't tell me Pur altogether. It's not a thesaurus. You have to tell me every kind of word for Lot. Therefore, I think it's not a translation. It is a statement, a slogan. Hipil Pur. Haman drew a lot. Hu HaGoral, and he said, that is your destiny. Your destiny is not in the hands of any god. It's in the hands of chance. And therefore, because the world is in the hand of chance, who is in control? The mighty, powerful, and rich. And I am mighty, powerful, and rich, and I can do anything I want to you. And I don't have to do it tomorrow. I can wait 11 months to do it then. Nobody's going to stop me. That's what Haman said. Hu HaGoral. It's interesting. The word hu is spelled Hey Vav Aleph. Turn it around backwards. What do you have? Aleph Vav Hey. Those are the letters from God's throne and God's name. By saying Pur Hu Hagoro, Haman turned around the letters Aleph Vav Hey and tried to uproot them and make them turn around backwards, back out of the world. And what was the miracle of Purim? The Nahapo Hu. The Hu turned back around to be Aleph Vav Hey instead of Hey Vav Aleph. Okay. So, however, after Haman decided to destroy the Jewish people, and they were under the threat, they decided, like people say, there's no atheists in a foxhole. So even though they assumed that God had abandoned them, but now maybe didn't. So they started to turn to pray and to cry and to fast, and they started to find the Rabbanu Shalom again, and maybe he didn't abandon us. And then when they started to do tshuva for the sin of not believing that God was involved with them, and Mamela, that they're important people, that's why it says they fasted, tzom, and they cried, umispeid, and they made hespedim, eulogies. Who are they eulogizing? Nobody died yet. I was thinking they're eulogizing themselves, and they were saying the following: you know, if God is really still involved with us, and we're davening to him, and crying, and fasting, then maybe, you know, we're really important people. Because if God is involved with us, we are important. What a shame it would be for such important people to be killed. That's the hesped. So, and therefore the Rabban Shom sent two individuals, two tzaddikim, to atone for the sins that they committed. Mordechai atoned for the sin of bowing down to the pestle of Nebuchadnezzar by not bowing down to Haman. The opposite. Mordechai made the opposite cheshbon. If I bow down to Haman, I'll be in his good grace, but not in the good graces of God. And if I don't bow down, I'll be in the good graces of God, but not in the good graces of Haman. Who runs the world? God, not Haman. The opposite of what they did when they bowed down to the son of Nebuchadnezzar. And Esther atoned for the second sin. They enjoyed the party of Achashverosh. She did more than just rub shoulders with Achashverosh. She was his wife. And she considered it her downfall. She didn't get any enjoyment out of that. She didn't consider that her importance. Her importance was being a Jewish woman. Kashira vadati or vadati. So she atoned for the sin of enjoying the party, and Mordechai atoned for the sin of bowing down to the pestle of Nebuchadnezzar. And that exactly is the miracle of Purim. The miracle of Purim teaches us two things. God never abandons us. He's always there, albeit behind the scenes. And because of that, we're very important. Those are the two lessons. That's what we say in Shoshana Siakov. What do we say in Shoshana Siakov? Shoshana Siakov, when the Jewish people are like a Shoshana ben Achochim. It means simply the Jews of Shushan. But the Medrash says that in Golus, we are like a rose or a lily amongst the thorns. Even when we are amongst the nations of the world, God doesn't abandon us. How do we know that? When they saw how the events came about, and that God was still behind the scenes organizing and orchestrating everything, so they were very happy. They saw that God didn't abandon them. And Tcheles Mordechai simply means when Mordechai came out of the king's palace wearing the robes of blue, so the whole thing turned around. They saw that God was behind the scenes. But even more than that, the Tcheles, it says, is the similar to the sea, and the sea is similar to the sky, and the sky is similar to God's throne. That Tcheles reminds us that God's sitting on his throne and he's controlling the world. From that we learn the first lesson of Purim, that ultimately God will save us. He never abandons us. There's a plan, and ultimately he will save us. Even though in every generation we don't see that. There's some generations where we see the Jews being oppressed and murdered. But tikvosam bechol dor vador. We may not be saved in every generation. That's in the end. But in every generation, at least now, we have hope. Because God never abandons us. Lahodia, and that teaches us a second lesson. If God never abandons us and he's always there, then we are very important people, because God has a special relationship with us and he gave us a Torah. Lahodia, shekol kovecha lo yevoshu. All those that hope and trust in God will never have reason to be embarrassed. We have nothing to be embarrassed about. We're very important people. The lo yikom lanetzach kol klimas, where somebody else insults you. We may be insulted. We have nothing to be embarrassed about ever. We may be insulted on the short term by other nations, but that's not forever. Even they one day will recognize who we are. Lo yikom lanetzach kol achosim boch. And therefore, there's good in this world and bad. It's not a haphazard accident, purposeless. Orer Haman, Baruch Mordechai, Arura, Zeresh, Brucha, Esther, the Gam Charbona Zochler. Everything has a purpose. There's good, there's bad. That is the lesson of Purim. And those are the mitzvahs of Purim. Right? The mitzvahs of Purim represent these ideas. The Megillah, reading the Megillah shows that God is behind the Megillah. That behind the events that happened, right? Even though it appears to be haphazard things, but if you put them together, you see God's hand. You see it couldn't be a coincidence. So the Megillas Esther is Megala HaHester. It reveals God's hidden hand. That's why it says the Megillah has to be like a Sefer Torah. It's Emes, like the Torah, and it needs Sirtut. You have to indent lines in the parchment before you write a Megillah, just like you indent lines in the Torah before you write the Torah. What does that mean? I think it means the following. People think that events happen, and the way they happen, that's how they're recorded in the Torah. But the line tells me no. The events just didn't happen. There was a line. There was a plan. There was a path. Before anything happened, there's already a plan. And the events line up on that almost invisible line that's God's plan in the background. And that's the Megillah. You see a plan. You see a line. You don't just see haphazard things being written down because that's how they happened. Before you wrote anything down, before anything happened, there was really a plan. There was a line. There was something directing this from almost invisible from behind. That is the Megillah. And if God is always there, which the Megillah teaches us, then we have the other mitzvahs that represent the other side. Then we're important people. If you consider yourself important, you want to promote yourself. How do you promote yourself? Eat. So it's a mitzvah of Suda. Eat. Drink. Right? Add a few calories. Make a little bit more of yourself. But not just you, because you're not important because you're you. You're important because you're a Jew. So give your friend something to eat. That's Mishloach Manos. And don't only give your friend, because then you can think that, well, we're important because we're rich, smart. Give an Evyon who has nothing. Give him not tzedakah. Give him a present, because he's also important. Important people, you give presents. Even has nothing. He's an Evyon. But he's a Jew. Give him. Show how important Jews are. There's another reason for Matanos Levyonim, because Matanos Levyonim is like tzedakah. Because there's a danger. When I think that God controls the world, so I could think that I shouldn't give tzedakah. Let God give the... Why do I have to... God can take care of the ani. He takes care of the world. The answer is, it's true. God could take care of the ani. It's ridiculous to think. God gave me extra money to give to the ani. Cut out the middleman. Give it directly to him. Turnus Rufus HaRosha, Ask Rabbi Akiva, if God loves poor people so much, why does he support them? And Rabbi Akiva told him God could support the ani. But he does it for the sake of the usher, to give him a merit to save him from Gehenna. The purpose of tzedakah is not for the sake of the ani. God can give the ani money. It's for the sake of the usher to give him a merit. And that's what the Gemara says. Yoser mimasheh usher osim ha'ani, ha'ani osim ha'asher. More than the usher does for the ani, he gives him money. God can give him money. But the ani gives the usher the ability to do a mitzvah that even God can't do, because everything's in the hands of God except for Yirah Shamayim. So that is the purpose of the mitzvahs of Purim. Now it's interesting, okay, just to put the icing on the cake with the cherry on the top. Purim, our Purim, can only fall on 4 days of the week. It can never fall on Shabbos. Yud Daled Adar, Shushan Purim can fall on Shabbos, but the regular Purim can never fall on Shabbos. It can never fall on Wednesday, and it can never fall on Monday. Those 3 days of the week are impossible according to the calendar we have. So that leaves Sunday. Purim can be Sunday, Moshe Shabbos. Purim could be Tuesday, Purim could be Thursday, and Purim could be Friday, like it is, not this week, this year is Thursday, but it could be Friday too. Those are the 4 days. What are the letters that represent those 4 days of the week? Sunday, Aleph. Friday, Vav. Thursday, Hey. Those are the three letters that are missing from God's name and from His throne. There's only one problem. There's one more day, Tuesday. What's Tuesday? Gimel. Put the Gimel in front of the Aleph of Hey, what do you get? Gaiva. Pride. That's the pride of the Jewish people. The fact that God's throne is complete and His name is complete, meaning that God is there and He doesn't abandon us, is the Gaiva, is the pride of the Jewish people. Those are the two messages of Purim. God is always there, and if He's always there, then you're very important. That is, and those are the 4 days, Gimel, Aleph, Vav, Hey, those are the days that Purim can fall.